You're listening to KBOO Portland.
The flowers are blooming, the birds are singing, and KBOO's spring membership drive is back. If you enjoy alternative radio that pushes the status quo, then support KBOO by becoming a member today. Donate online at bit.ly/KBOO or text KBOO to 44321 between now and May 25th and support Avant-Garde Airwaves.
look at here. I got to get up and do my thing. Okay, well, let me kind of move these things around here, you know. Let me get up and do my thing, yeah, you understand? Can I really get into it?
Yeah.
Can I get into the thing, really?
Yeah.
Like a sex machine?
Yeah.
Moving?
Yeah.
Doing it?
Yeah.
Can I get into it?
Yeah.
Can I get into all our things?
Yeah.
We ready to get into it?
Yeah.
I'm going to count it off, Jab.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4.
The following program is a special encore rebroadcast for these unique pandemic times. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred and are no longer relevant. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
Good morning and welcome to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform, which means we are funded by you, the listener. Today we consider the new BFI monograph on Luchino Visconti's The Leopard. But first we get a double dose of Jeff Godsell's Essentials of Cinema, starting with History is Made at Night.
Andrew Saris called it the most romantic title in the history of cinema, and it was directed by one of its most prolific romantics. Frank Borsagi had made nearly 60 films, 40 of them during the silent era, when he made History is Made at Night in 1937 with Charles Boyer and Jean Arthur. Despite being a two-time Oscar winner, Borsagi was then languishing at Warner Brothers, being given mostly trivial projects like Dick Powell and Ruby Keeler musicals. When producer Walter Wanger approached him, he jumped at the chance to do History is Made at Night, even though all they had to begin with was the title and a couple of pages of script. Jean Arthur plays Irene Vale, unhappily married to wealthy ship owner Bruce Vale, played by Colin Clive in his second-to-last film. Vale is maniacally possessive of Irene, bitterly jealous, and falsely accusing her of infidelity. Irene has had enough and tells him that she's seeking a divorce. Vale learns that he can block the divorce if he can provide evidence that she's been involved with another man within 6 months of filing. He arranges for his driver to go to Irene's hotel room in Paris and pretend to be her lover, whereby a private detective will catch them in what appears to be an uncompromising position. But unknownst to both of them, an unknown man has been watching through the window on the balcony. He bursts into the room defending Irene, and in the struggle, the driver ends up on the floor, unconscious. When Vale and the private detective burst into the room, the man threatens them with a gun, demands Irene's jewelry, and takes her away as a hostage. Once in a taxi, fleeing the scene, Irene is astonished when the man returns her jewelry, explaining that due to the circumstances, he could tell that something was up, and some quick thinking allowed them both to escape. The man introduces himself as Paul Dumont and invites Irene to dine with him at the Chateau Bleu, and she accepts. But as they arrive, they find that the restaurant is closed and the chef, as well as the small orchestra, is just leaving. But Paul, played by Charles Boyer, is not without charm, and he seems to have some clout. He persuades them all to return inside where the two have a lovely dinner and they dance the night away. At this point, History is Made at Night has dipped into distinctly different genres, the suspense film and the romantic comedy, and it isn't finished yet. The ease with which Borsagi is navigating us is reminiscent of Lubitsch, even if the dialogue is less scintillating and the humor a little less wry. By the end, we'll be diving even into the disaster film, with an ending that wasn't even written until 2 weeks before it was shot. But what is perhaps the most impressive thing about History is Made at Night is that even with all of these unpredictabilities during the production, it is unmistakably a Frank Borsagi film, fitting perfectly into his canon and standing out as one of his best. But back to the story. It turns out that Vale has killed the driver that night and convinces everyone that it was the unknown man who was the murderer. Vale blackmails Irene into returning with him to America. Paul, it turns out, was the head waiter at Chateau Bleu, a considerably high position in France. When he learns that Irene has returned, he embarks for New York, along with his good friend and chef, Cesar, played delightfully by Leo Carrillo. There, they rehabilitate a restaurant in Manhattan, making it one of the best places to dine in New York, in the hopes that Irene will one day walk through those doors. This single-minded determination is typical of a Borsagi protagonist and evidence of what Saris called his belief in love over probability. Irene does indeed come to dine, along with her unsuspecting husband. But their happiness is short-lived when Paul learns of the driver's death, believing that he was responsible. And when a different man is arrested in Paris for the crime, Paul feels compelled to return to Paris to clear the man's name. Irene insists on going with him, and the two travel on the Princess Irene, the very liner owned by Vale and named after her. When Vale learns of this, he goes into a rage, ordering the ship's captain to run at full speed to break the record for the fastest crossing ever, despite the danger of icebergs. Sure enough, the ship collides with an iceberg, and news reports indicate that the ship has sunk, with a death toll potentially higher than the Titanic. Even though it is what he had hoped for, Vale becomes consumed by guilt, committing suicide and leaving a note confessing his murder of the driver. But miraculously, the bulkhead doors manage to contain just enough water on the ship to keep it from sinking. The lovers are saved, and the future awaits. There is plenty to admire in History Is Made at Night, not the least of which is how the leads, both Boyer and Arthur, have never looked so natural, so free to express. It is as if, at least for one film, they were able to soften the edges of the typecasting that had nonetheless deservedly made them stars. There's a playfulness to Boyer in contrast to the dark, brooding foreigner that he so often played, including the picture he'd just finished, The Garden of Allah, with Marlene Dietrich. And what is remarkable is how, even with this hodgepodge nature of the script, Borsegi was able to mold the film in his artistic image, the very definition of the auteur theory, and to invest his characters with the same unwavering belief that romantic love is the highest objective that a human can aspire to. For Borsegi, this was a given. Even though they may not even say, "I love you," their commitment is unquestioned, their desires certain. Like Gary Cooper and possibly Borsegi's masterpiece, the 1932 A Farewell to Arms, Boyer displays an uncomplicated sense of purpose, admirable in its determination. The audience, like Irene, has no choice but to surrender to its truth. Despite being called one of Hollywood's most romantic directors, Borsegi never spoke of love in platitudes. He didn't even refer to his films as love stories, but rather human interest stories. Actors loved him as he encouraged them to act like, well, people would. His films may not have been as sophisticated as Lubitsch, or as funny as McCary or LaCava, or as earnest as John Stahl, but they contain some of the best elements of all of them. And History Is Made at Night is no exception. I strongly recommend the Criterion DVD of the film, featuring some great critical and historical discussion, as well as an audio interview with Borsegi from 1958. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
So KBOO is now in the middle of our spring membership drive, and we are trying to raise $60,000 by the end of this month. So we'd like you to go to KBOO. This just in. Now go to bet.ly/KBOO to subscribe to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Once again, that's bit.ly/KBOO. Do it today.
Next, Jeff reminds us of W.C. Fields and It's a Gift.
Back in the late 60s and 70s, there was a kind of a revival of some of the great film comedians of the 30s. The Marx Brothers, W.C. Fields, and Mae West were being discovered and appreciated by a new generation. Their films were popping up at festivals and college campuses. Their popularity was attributed by some to their irreverent, and in the case of the Marx Brothers, even anarchic humor. It seemed to fit the new counterculture with its anti-establishment point of view. And while there's some truth to this sociological explanation, a better one is simply that most of their films were still funny. You didn't see a revival of, say, the Ritz Brothers or Wheeler and Woolsey because, quite simply, their films were not. Revisiting these iconic clowns today, the best of their films are still funny. even if their names are brought up less and less with each new generation. Sadly, the one that seems most to be fading, with the general public at least, is W.C. Fields, although most contemporary comics know and love him.
How do you do, sir? Can you sit down?
Manicure?
No. Haircut or shave?
Yeah.
I beg your pardon. Isn't your name Flug?
Yeah.
I thought so. I didn't recognize your face when you first came in.
No, it's all healed up since I was in here last.
Did you know you had your hat on backwards?
Oh, no. Oh, thank you very much. I had it on backwards day before yesterday, and a friend of mine came up and kicked me in the stomach.
Hey, what's that dog doing in here?
Oh, it's a very funny thing. The other day, a man was in here, and I was shaving him. The razor slipped, and I cut his ear off. The dog got it. Ever since, he's been hanging around here for... Go away, go away, go away.
Fields was 50 years old when the talkies arrived. By then, he had already been in show business for over 30 years. First as a juggler, and then in vaudeville and with the Ziegfeld Follies for 6 years. Fields even made a dozen silent films, surprising considering how verbal his comedy is. All the while, he was creating and perfecting his comic persona. While sometimes showing a mean streak, especially toward children and dogs, Fields was at his best as the henpecked husband, trying to get by, but constantly at odds with everything and everybody. In some ways, he was the Larry David of the 30s, always getting into scrapes, some of which weren't actually his fault. With his roly-poly stature and bulbous nose, Fields remained lovable, and if he liked to have a nip now and then, well, who could blame him? Fields' drinking was legendary, and he was able to work it into his characters quite well. Many of his sound films are just reworkings of routines that he had been perfecting for years. The screenplays, such as they were often constructed by Fields himself, using his colorful pseudonyms like Otis Kribblecoblis and Mahatma Kane Jeeves. While many of his films contain priceless moments, his best... It's a Gift from 1934 is perfection from beginning to the end of its tight 68 minutes.
Open the door for Mr. Merkel.
What?
Open the door for Mr. Merkel, the blind man.
How about my kumquats?
What'd you say?
Kumquats!
Wait!
All right. You got that door closed again, huh?
I'm awfully sorry. Come on, this
way. What's that?
Don't do
Wait,
that.
What's that?
It's all right. Think nothing of it. Just little glassware.
What?
Just little glassware.
What's the matter with you? Can't you talk?
Here's your pipe. Here. What can I do for you?
Have you got any chewing gum?
Yes, we have.
How about my kumquats?
Coming.
Fields plays put upon grocer Harold Bissonette, or Bissonnet, as his wife prefers, and as Fields tries in vain to correct many others. It's Harold against the world, but fortune seems to come in the form of an inheritance. With this, Harold can make his dream come true. He buys a plot of land in California where he and his family can retire with an orange grove, just like the one in the photo that he's been carrying around. It isn't long before it's discovered that the land is worthless, but not before some hilarious vignettes involving a display of light bulbs in the store and a blind and deaf customer, as well as Fields' attempt to get some sleep on his balcony, only to be interrupted in the most improbable and unfortunate ways. The family heads out west in their old jalopy just the same, getting into a couple of scrapes along the way. Looking at the beautiful California landscape en route, Mrs. Bissonette starts to warm a bit, thinking, well, maybe this wasn't such a bad decision after all. Well, all hopes are dashed, however, on arrival, when they see that their new land is a barren plot with a rundown shack and a tumbleweed. How can this end well? Well, in a W.C. Fields movie, it can and will. As a car pulls up and a developer gets out, desperate to buy Bissonette's land, to put up a grandstand next to his new planned racetrack. Fields pulls out his well-worn photo of his dream orange grove.
That's what he wants, and that's what he gets. Fields appeared in 5 movies in 1934. Then, after appearing in David Copperfield as Micawber in 1935 in a stroke of casting genius, Fields' output waned. Heavy drinking and chronic illnesses were taking its toll. After his last film for Paramount, The Big Broadcast of 1938, Fields was physically unable to appear for long on a set. It was radio that kept Fields' career alive, appearing several times on the Bergen and McCarthy show, developing a long-running mock feud between him and the ventriloquist dummy Charlie McCarthy. Writers had a field day with McCarthy targeting Fields' bulbous red nose, while Fields would remind McCarthy that he was made of wood. His health somewhat returning, Fields enjoyed a major late-life revival when Universal signed him for the films that many remember him best for. After You Can't Cheat an Honest Man came The Bank Dick, My Little Chickadee with Mae West, and finally the surrealist Never Give a Sucker an Even Break, featuring the movie within a movie, with Fields pitching his thoroughly ridiculous screenplay to the studio. Wacky as they are, these later films relied a bit more on slapstick for my taste, and they just can't compare with the comic perfection of It's a Gift.
I want kumquats!
Coming! Oh, almost forgot the chewing gum.
Where's my gum?
Here's your chewing gum. 5 cents, please.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lug that with me. Send it.
Oh, yes.
Heaven!
This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. And don't forget to drop into Jeff's website, Essentials of Cinema, for even more recommendations. And you're listening to Film at 11 here on Community Radio KBOO Portland. Please consider becoming a member today. And now let's reconsider Visconti's The Leopard with the help of the new British Film Institute monograph on the film. Back in the 1920s, the lord of magnificence and expenditure was Erich von Stroheim in a series of epical films set within European aristocracy, such as The Wedding Party and several others. He explored the mores of the sort of people that one would think his Vaughn indicated were his milieu. His extravagance included having various characters wear exquisite underwear despite the fact that the audience would never see it. Sadly, this extravagance inevitably led to a clash with the studio, MGM, and his career was slowly dismantled. Not unlike—
Hi, this is Mark Sanford Gross, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our spring membership drive.